Shrink Wrap Radio number 283, an update on the positive potential of psychedelics with James Vadiman.
Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is author, educator, and transpersonal psychologist, Dr. James Vadiman. We'll be discussing his 2011 book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, Safe, Therapeutic, and Sacred Journeys. For more detail on his background, please go to the show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. James Vadiman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have a chance to speak with you. We've been traveling in overlapping circles for years, you at the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology and me in the psychology department at Sonoma State University. And as a result, we know many of the same people. And I've interviewed some of them here, for example, Stan Krippner, Stan Groff, Charlie Tart, David Lukoff, and Dean Radin, to name just a few.
Oh, yes.
So I know you know those people.
We might have even been closer had I taking a job. I was offered a job at Sonoma State in the psychology department 1 year out of graduate school, and for reasons that are probably wrong, I turned it down.
Well,
and never was offered a job in a psychology department again.
Well, you went on to start your own graduate school.
Right. Well, it's the only place that would offer me a job.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was an extraordinary place. I probably came along a bit after that job was offered to you. I want to frame our discussion. You've written a very fascinating book on psychedelics, and I want to frame it at the beginning with the kind of proviso that you put in the front of your book, and I'll read that right now. You've written right opposite the table of contents. It says, nothing contained herein is intended to encourage or support illegal behavior. However, even though the use of psychedelics remains illegal in the United States, government researchers estimate that more than 23 million Americans have used LSD, and at least that many more people have used it worldwide. Given that psychedelics continue to be widely available, this material has been prepared to encourage safe and sacred ways to use psychedelics, if these powerful substances are to be used at all. So that's the caution at the beginning of your book, and I will claim it as the caution for this podcast.
Good. And one more caution that I've needed to make now and then, because I get a lot of more and more interesting mail, is psychedelics are not for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Not for everybody. Is that clear?
Yeah, I definitely agree. Before we get into your background and your new book, psychedelics have been in the news in the past couple of weeks, and I'd like to get your comments on two recent stories. Sadly,
sure.
As you know, Steve Jobs just passed away. And he credited using, I didn't know this until he passed, and then I saw news stories, that he credited using LSD as a big part of his success. In an interview with New York Times reporter John Markoff, Jobs once said, doing LSD was one of the two or three most important things I've done in my life. He added that, I like this, he added that Bill Gates would be, quotes, a broader guy if he had dropped acid once. and he also went on to say that there were things about him, about Steve Jobs, that people who had not tried psychedelics, even people who knew him well, including his wife, could never understand. So what do you think about that?
Well, what's wonderful about that quote, and I've also quoted it in my book very quietly, is that Steve Jobs took acid as part of his kind of coming of age. He also went to India. He also became a serious Buddhist. And these were all the kind of background on which he began to be interested not only in computers, but as he said in another interview, on bringing the liberal arts to computers. And what he felt is that it was important that people feel not only okay with a technical device, but good about it, and that aesthetically it should be beautiful, and it should look on the screen beautiful. And I think that all came from this combination of really 60s internal liberation, where his worldview was stretched wide open. And so I'd like to, you know, think that psychedelics were critical in the development of the products, but they probably weren't. But the nature of the whole company and the nature of the products really does come from his own realization that people should feel pleasure in what they do, and that there is no distinction between the natural and the technical.
Well, my listeners know that I'm a Macintosh, what they call a fanboy. I'm a real Mac fanatic. I've been using Apple products since the Apple II. And speaking of the 60s, and, you know, that this kind of came out of that whole zeitgeist of the 60s, one of the places he was coming from, you remember one of the refrains of that period was power to the people. And he really thought that computers could be, which at the time were the property of the military-industrial complex, those were the only people that had computers. And he really felt that the, quotes, the people at large should have access to this powerful tool.
Well, it's even a little deeper than that, because John Markoff's book, which is just a delight, called What the Dormouse Said, asked the question of why on earth did the personal computer originate in Northern California at a time when all the smart computer people, the kind of big doctors and dudes in this area, were on the East Coast. And he literally took a big bookstore in Menlo Park, an independent bookstore called Kepler's, drew a one-mile circle around it, and started interviewing. And what he found was that it was the interface of people like Steve Jobs, who were interested in gadgets, and the people who were using psychedelics, who were, many of them, again, scientists of all sorts. And those overlapping interests seemed to lead to the whole personal computer industry, to the Whole Earth Catalog, and to a lot of things.
Yeah, Stuart Brand is somebody else who's one of my heroes that I've had contact with, speaking of the Whole Earth Catalog. And there was, in fact, legal LSD research going on in Northern California at that time, right? And that was how I do want to get into your story. I think I'll postpone this part because I also wanted to talk. We'll come back to that because there was a second story in the news that I thought was very significant, and I sent you a link to it. And that's a study of psilocybin, which is extracted from what are known as magic mushrooms or the psilocybin mushroom, and a new study that showed that there are long-term personality changes. I almost want to say, duh.
Well, that there was a wonderful article in the San Francisco Gate by Mark Mumford who says, duh, at the top of his lungs.
He does.
but what the study really was showing is that the personality changes that you have after a spiritual psychedelic experience, and that was very critical, are one of them is what he calls openness.
Yes.
And that's openness to experience, to creativity, to relationships, and it's seen as a sign of health. And the fact that after a year, which is as far as they've looked at the moment, that holds, makes sense once you let go of the medical model. The medical model says you put a chemical, a drug, a substance into your body, it has an effect, like aspirin, your headache, you don't feel it, it may be actually going away, and then when the aspirin is done, the symptoms may or may not return, but your body kind of returns to normal. And that's the medical model. The educational model is you have an experience brought about by drugs, by reading, by going to a movie, by being with someone, by going to Paris, and your worldview changes. You learn something. It's kind of what education is supposed to do.
I love that distinction. Yeah, go ahead.
And the learning is of course, retained.
Yes.
And therefore, what you're seeing is not a kind of long-term biochemical rearrangement, but what you're seeing is, being more open makes my life richer and better. Why would I close back down?
Yeah.
So it's a very different model.
Yeah, I like your take on the two models. That's a nice way of positioning it. According to the article that I read, I guess openness is on a standard psychological inventory known as measuring the big five, and I don't off the top remember
right,
what the other
five factors of personality.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing about the test is it's one of those tests which says this is really stable, this does not change.
Right,
you know, this is like your eye color and your fingerprints.
And that's why this finding was deemed so dramatic.
Well, what's wonderful for me, and it's a kind of quiet pleasure, is the article goes on to say no one's ever, measured this before. But in some of our early work, we picked another measure that was supposed to be stable, that was popular then, called the MMPI, which has hundreds of little questions and measures all kinds of things. But one of the things about it, it's supposed to be stable. And what we found is after an entheogenic, and we'll talk about what that word means in a moment, but a large dose in a therapeutic setting, that very basic personality structures not only changed, but took at least 6 months to a year before they would restabilize into a new configuration.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
So we're talking about a profound shift in worldview and in how one approaches oneself.
Yes. Now, one of the things I love about your book is that it's so intensely personal. The book has an unusual kind of organization. It's kind of a mix of your writing, some of other people's writings, but it's not really an anthology or a collection of essays or anything like that. It's definitely got your imprint throughout it. A guide for psychedelic voyagers and their guides and so on. Now, but I love the fact that it's so personal. You're very open about your own experiences. And you were really in the right place at the right time in terms of the immense cultural shift that was the 60s. And in the book, you said you led three lives. And I'm old enough to remember Herbert A. Philbrick and the show.
Oh, yes.
I Led Three Lives. So take us through your three lives of that period, if you will.
Well, I was I graduated from college and collected all the gifts and money and savings and went off to Europe. And I was living like a mouse on the fifth floor of a walk-up fifth-floor apartment in Paris, writing a not terribly good novel and feeling very, very happy with myself. And my old undergraduate mentor and personal friend, Richard Alpert, appeared.
So were you at Harvard then?
Yeah, I had graduated from Harvard.
Okay.
And with no particular career intention, but certainly not to go to graduate school. And I was off, assuming that I was going to be discovered and become a famous novelist and have women begging for me and all the things that one does at age 20 when one is living alone.
Yeah, yeah.
And he showed up on his way to Copenhagen with Tim Leary and Aldous Huxley, where they were going to do the first presentation to an international psychology conference about these substances. And he said, the greatest thing in the world has happened to me, and I want to share it with you. Now, that's a hard offer to turn down from your favorite teacher.
Yeah. And we, in case anybody doesn't recognize the name Richard Alpert, he later became Baba Ram Dass and then just Ram Dass. So keep going.
So I said, sure. And then he reached in his pocket and pulled out a little thing of pills. And I thought, this is bizarre, because I had no information and no knowledge and no interest. However, I took psilocybin that night and began to understand that my worldview was limited and that my identity was really a lot better and healthier than I thought. And a week later, I had left Paris and basically kind of ran after them to Copenhagen, where again I worked for this material and really learned about human closeness. And then I ended up at Stanford for graduate school, mainly because that was an alternative to Vietnam. And as much as graduate school didn't look too good, I thought I would be a very poor soldier.
That's how I got into graduate school as well.
So I just didn't think that crawling on my elbows and knees through mud with a rifle was going to be, you know, I was going to be a credit to me or my country. Particularly after psychedelics, the idea of killing other people really is hard to get your head around. So I did come to Stanford, and I did end up with a psychedelic research team in Menlo Park that was doing basic clinical research with an investigational drug exemption license from the government. And from there, really, is how I learned much deeper and much more profound uses for these substances.
And so that's one of your three lives, or maybe that's two.
Right.
Maybe that's two of your
three
lives.
By day, I was a graduate student, and because psychedelics were both unknown and unpopular, and the Harvard scandals were starting, I was the only graduate student at Stanford in psychology who regularly wore a jacket and a tie when I walked around campus. And my theory was that I would fool them, and they wouldn't have any idea of what I was really up to. And I'm sorry to say, given the quality of the Stanford faculty, that it worked perfectly. And at night, I was desperately reading things like the Tibetan Book of the Dead and Huxley and many other things like that to make sense of what this new expanded universe was that I was part of. So literally, maybe I only led two lives, but I was looked like a dull graduate student by day and a unrepentant psychedelic hippie by night. And I also ended up having being a kind of outlier among the Kesey crowd, the Ken Kesey group, who were doing what you might call open-ended field research, which is they were taking pretty much anything they could get and trying it out in every way possible.
And of course, Tom Wolfe's, the second Tom Wolfe's book, I think that was his first big book, The Electric Acid Candy Kool-Aid Test, is that it?
Yeah, that's the one in which Dorothy, my wife, and I appear, and I'm taking the I Ching, the Chinese Book of Divination, to Ken Kesey in jail, and a bunch of us also ended up pledging our homes for his bail. So we were involved.
Okay. Well, young listeners who weren't alive during that period, I recommend that book to you. It'll help give you a sense of that period of time and what was going on in that particular subculture. So that's what I mean about you being in the right place at the right time. Some people might say the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, what was wonderful is I was in the available wrong places at the right time simultaneously.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, sometimes when I think about the 60s, and I don't want to wax too nostalgic here, but I sometimes feel like maybe the planet was passing through some kind of an archetypal field or something, that there was something that's, that was going on that maybe was more than LSD and more than political protests and more than the Vietnam War. Do you have any reflections about that?
Yeah, what it seems like from the really more from the psychedelic world's point of view is that we were able to see through what the Buddhists call illusion, and to see that the institutions which were supposed to be of value and help were constricting. And that was certainly the military, it was certainly education, it was certainly government. And in our naivete, what we felt is if enough of us understood that, we would simply get rid of them and change them and redo them. And what we didn't quite understand is all the people who were running them were not open to that.
Right.
And saw our very clear disillusion as a personal attack, particularly when the disillusion, you know, let us say you're running a bank in Vermont, and you're a perfectly decent banker and you're making a profit, and you may not be the, you probably aren't doing the kind of things bankers do today. But then your children suddenly say to you, money isn't a good thing to have, Dad. What you really need to do is return to the land. And the parent very appropriately thinks his children have gone crazy.
Yeah.
So you really had a generational shift that was very, very difficult for parents to deal with. I did a set of films for KQED called Drugs, Your Children Are Choosing. And it was to really let parents know something of what was going on with their children so they would be able to cope, learn, benefit, and also not lose track of each other. So it was a very different era in terms of hopeful optimism.
Yeah, I've just been watching a really fine film on HBO about George Harrison.
Oh, yes.
And so it kind of goes through his progression, the progression of the Beatles. And, you know, after their initial explorations, experimenting with LSD, particularly for George, it really led to an interest in spirituality and meditation and it seems to have had that same effect for many others.
Well, that was, again, what you saw is if the leading world rock stars were becoming interested in meditation and in spiritual issues, then we were really in a cultural shift. Lady Gaga doesn't have the same impact and doesn't have the same interest as the Beatles did.
What was that progression for you, since you went on to co-found an institution called the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology? I have to assume that there was some kind of spiritual transformation in your life. What was your spiritual orientation before and then after your psychedelic experiences?
Well, my spiritual orientation before was pretty much Unitarian, which is kind of liberal literacy. And hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. And what that really meant was that I was kind of aware that the rigidity of conventional religion didn't seem realistic, but I didn't really have much interest in what lay behind it. And at one point, when I was a graduate student and now into psychedelics, the local Unitarian youth people called me and said, we'd like you to give a talk. And I said, what shall I talk about? And they said, oh, we're Unitarians. You can talk about anything. I said, okay, I'm going to talk about God. And there was this wonderful dead pause on the phone. And I said, it's okay, I'm only kidding. I'll talk about psychedelics. And so I think that was the shift, is I moved from a kind of intellectual liberalism to an awareness that the internal sense of personal divinity is shared by all beings. and that not only that internal sense of divinity is available, but that it certainly transcends any kind of religious system differences. So that saints all sound pretty much the same from every tradition, and theologians argue from every tradition.
Okay.
And I moved into the group that wasn't going to argue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I have the impression that research on psychedelics is beginning to open up again. Is that true? And if so, what's caused the shift?
Well, someone, I think, very optimistically calls it a renaissance. I would call it more like the camel's nose has been allowed back under the tent.
Okay.
And what's happened after 40 years of no published research, and as you indicated in the beginning of the program, 23 million Americans taking LSD, and we should add to that, that number goes up still 400,000 to 600,000 a year. So for a substance that's not available, that's illegal, and you can't research, that's a pretty exciting history. And if you then extend it to realize that the people in power at the regulatory agencies, at the lawyers, the judges, many of the politicians have also had psychedelic experience, and the one thing that they found out was that it wasn't frightening and terrible and didn't lead to insanity, death, and, you know, and loss of facial hair. And so when the researchers who've been quietly thinking about this for many years approached the government agencies said, we have lots of regulations, but if you simply do everything in the regulations, we will support you if it's science. And in the old days, there was research, for instance, in Canada, where the treatment for alcoholism with LSD-assisted therapy was sufficiently successful and sufficiently understood that it was no longer experimental. It was simply listed in the province of Saskatchewan as one of the things available. Particularly exciting to the people in Saskatchewan is that your long-term treatment-resistant alcoholics who were now beginning to deal with cirrhosis and worse, given one psychedelic experience in a supportive setting with some follow-up, had a close to 50% abstinence rate. And the control group, which was the same people before the treatment, was, you know, close to zero. So it was very exciting. And that data was presented to the person in charge of the federal government's alcoholism research unit. And he said, and I quote from someone who was at that meeting, I don't believe this data. And the person, not unrealistically, said to him, Dr. such and such, what data would you believe about this kind of work? He said, none.
Yeah, right. You know, that speaks to paradigm shift, Thomas Kuhn's famous idea.
So that basically isn't occurring anymore.
Yeah.
And so when the two studies that you quoted come out, not only did was there no kind of pushback from the federal government, but there were 200 to 300 media mentions around the planet of each of those studies. And people have said, why does it get so much press so fast, this very little study? And my own theory is, and if you read, for example, Time magazine, you really get it clearly, is the reporters covering this have had their own experience. So they are delighted to bring to light what they already know from their personal experience.
Yeah, it's just like what's happening with research on meditation. I think that a generation of younger psychologists and brain researchers have grown up who were already meditators or certainly were open to it. And so suddenly meditation explodes with all of this new research.
Exactly. And I think now it's kind of common knowledge that If you don't know much else, you do know that meditation is good for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you also know that yoga is good for you.
Right.
And you may then know lots of details like you and I know, but that's a basic shift. And I think my interest in kind of reemerging and taking a serious public stand around psychedelics is used correctly. And I mean that with a very big underlining, used correctly, psychedelics seem to be very good for people. That doesn't mean that they're safe. People misusing them get in terrible trouble, and now and then someone will say to me, well, you're on drugs, and I have a friend who's still in a mental hospital, and I say, I think that's so tragic that they didn't get the correct help and that they weren't understood and that they were so frightened by their own experience that they misused it. You know, it's no different for me when someone says, someone in a private plane crashed. And I don't say, well, let's ban people flying in private planes. But I sure say we better do a good job of educating pilots and educating mechanics and having regulations so that we can protect people when they do something that is out of the ordinary.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, synchronistically, just yesterday I received an email from a listener suggesting I should interview a Dr. Bill Richards at Johns Hopkins, who's doing...
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, you know him?
Yeah, Bill has been a guide, what I call a guide, someone mm-hmm. who assists people during the psychedelic experience from the end of the earlier research to, and then was kind of brought back to work with the Johns Hopkins people who are doing the spiritual studies and a number of other studies. And he's just one of the most gentle, good souls that you will ever run into, and is a licensed psychologist as well.
Well, that's great. I think I will try to track him down. This listener said that he was doing research on psilocybin with cancer patients.
And yeah, he's also there's a study going on that is working with end state cancer patients, terminal patients, to help them basically lower their sadness and anxiety and fear during the remaining months of their lives. And this is replicating the really wonderful study done by Charlie Grobe and Alicia Danforth and a few others at UCLA, where, again, to no one's total surprise, that people who are given psilocybin near the end of life, in most cases, find it an incredibly healing experience, and that the remaining months of their lives are lived much more carefully and much more beautifully than was true before they took psilocybin.
Is there any other current research that you're aware of that we could touch on here?
Oh, yeah, there's a wonderful bunch of research that's being done with MDMA, also called ecstasy, which is not exactly a psychedelic, but close enough. And it turns out that what's called MDMA-assisted psychotherapy with people with, again, what's called treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. Treatment-resistant is a medical term saying we weren't able to help you, but we kind of want to blame you for it.
Okay.
But in any case, these were people who, whatever the treatments are out there, and there are many, it didn't help. So we're dealing with people, not your average post-traumatic stress disorder person, but the hardcore. And the results have been so good that the initial study has been... again, replicated, and they're now doing another study where they're using, they're allowing in as potential subjects war veterans. And if you think about the hundreds of thousands of war veterans who are suffering, and that the conventional treatments just aren't very good. Nothing about the physicians who are using them, they're doing the best they can, but they don't work very well. Because we're not dealing with a biochemical imbalance, and we're not even dealing with kind of psychodynamics. We're dealing with something where your fundamental wiring has been violated. This is particularly true of people who have had to shoot and kill civilians mm-hmm. and children.
Mm-hmm.
You don't recover from that very easily. And so that's probably the most exciting research going on.
Where is that going on?
It's going on in Virginia.
Okay.
And it is with the full knowledge and support of the Food and Drug Administration and the various agencies. The VA is becoming aware of it, but right now it's a watch and see.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very hopeful, both because it really does open people's lives around. They can go back to work. They can be friendly with their families. They stop self-medicating. Self-medicating means alcohol and hard drugs. And they are incredibly, joyful at being able to let go of past trauma. And I'm not only talking about war, I'm talking about rape, I'm talking about severe abuse, things that really dominate your inner life and prevent you from having any kind of what we would call a normal, happy existence. So that's probably the very exciting.
Yeah. Now earlier you underscored taking psychedelics in the right way, in a safe way. And the first couple of chapters of your book actually are guidelines for voyagers and guides by the Guild of Guides. So we probably should touch on that.
Right. Well, those first two chapters are a compilation of the wisdom acquired both before and during the 40 years of no research on how to help people, in particular, if they wish to have a transcendent or spiritual or what's called entheogenic or kind of divinity awareness experience. And it's the work that I know best, and it's really the kind of the best practices. And just to ensure that your audience does not think that, oh, he's doing one of those, you got to buy my book numbers, those two chapters are available on the net at a site called EntheoGuide, EntheoGuide, one word, .net, which is a site that fortunately I have nothing to do with, but they asked me for those chapters. And it has some other very useful things for people who, in spite of it being illegal, are going to be doing it anyway.
Yeah, I just heard from a listener in Europe, I won't pinpoint it any more closely than that, who it sounds like is involved with a group of people who are following the sorts of safe practices that you advocate, using ayahuasca. And I was just surprised to learn that people in Europe are somehow able to obtain something like ayahuasca. I'd be interested in your comments about ayahuasca generally, and maybe to hit some of the high points of your recommendations of your guidelines.
Sure. Well, I have a chapter in the book which has a couple of just beautiful, beautiful ayahuasca reports, and it's a chapter that says, this book is not about this chapter. It's to let people know that my book is not about all psychedelics, in spite of the guide, in spite of the title, which obviously the publisher likes a lot. And it also is to really remind people there are lots of other ways. Ayahuasca is a difficult experience for most people, certainly the first time. And it is almost always taken, and this is why I'm very happy about it, it's almost always taken with a shaman, what's called an ahuasquero, or even a vegetista, meaning someone who has been trained in the use of many plants. And there are people from Ecuador and other places who do go to Europe and work with groups. There are also people who've been trained here by shamans who also work both here and in Europe. And, of course, there are several churches in the United States that originated in Brazil that have ayahuasca as a central sacrament.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And there's lots of research going on, again, mostly, again, not surprisingly, out of this country on the pharmacology and the psychology and the neurology, you know, neuropsychology, et cetera, of ayahuasca. But it's a very different it's a different set of experiences than the family my book is about, which is mainly LSD, psilocybin, and mescaline, and the plants that those come from. So my advice to people, if I was asked, is very, very, very important to understand the qualifications of your guide if you're going to use ayahuasca. And what's wonderful so far, though I'm sure it'll change, is nobody's figured out how to do it recreationally because it's not a lot of fun.
Hit for us the high points of your recommendations for guided
sure.
psychedelic sessions.
Okay, this is what really we started to learn 40, 50 years ago, and it's now done by every research group, which is you pay very attention to what's called set, or your mental attitude to setting, which is the physical situation, which should be as comfortable and as safe as possible and with access to nature, that you pay attention to the quality of your guide or your sitter and what their understanding is, because what we know is, and this is research really done by Leary and Alpert long ago, is that when a session got bad for a person, had what's called a bad trip, they saw very often it was when the guide became anxious or felt they were out of their depth. So quality of guide is important. The other three are the nature of the substance, what literally are you taking, and the dosage turns out to be very important. The session itself, how is it being conducted? Again, we're talking about safety and comfort and correct use of music and whatever other things that are available that I go into some detail. And then finally, the situation, which is what is the kind of world that you go back into after you've had the 8 to 12 hours of the intense experience, which is you go back into a family that would feel that you've just done, you know, a kind of anti-Christian devil worship, or do you go into a family that says, oh, you have found indeed what we have been talking about as a family and as friends for a long time. So there's a lot of things that make it work, and the thing that to keep in mind is we're never talking about a drug or a plant. We're talking about an experience, a multifaceted experience that is accelerated or potentiated or expanded or made available with a drug. But it is those, without those other things around you, set and setting and sitter and so forth, it can go wrong.
I have a question, and I'm not quite sure how to formulate it. One version of it is, does one outgrow the need to have psychedelic sessions? I think many of the people that I know from years ago stopped at some point. Is there a lesson to be learned, and after that point, it becomes a bit fruitless to keep trying to learn the same lesson over and over again, or not?
Well, as we know, neurosis is when you don't learn the same lesson over and over again. And I'm sure there are people who take their psychedelic insights and begin to lose them, and basically not much happens. Or they take it recreationally, and they never knew that if you did it differently, you'd learn something more. But what I've found, and I've been getting, let me quote Jack Kornfield, who's one of the great Buddhist teachers in the United States. He says 80% of the Buddhist teachers in the United States began their spiritual practice either just after using psychedelics or early on in their practice they use psychedelics. And what I've gotten is a number of letters from people from different spiritual traditions that say just what you're saying, is you should stop taking psychedelics at some point and become serious in your spiritual practice, but psychedelics seem to have been very helpful in starting off. So they seem to open one up to why people are willing to do year in and year out serious spiritual practice. And the question of should one, you know, does one outgrow the need to understand oneself is always an interesting question. Freud, as you know, wrote that analysis, in a wonderful article, analysis, you know, terminable or interminable, suggests that you never quite finish working on yourself. And I think with psychedelics, the question is, where are you in your life? And again, given that they're illegal, it does make it harder to get that good set and setting that I've talked about. So when someone says to me, well, should I take psychedelics? And my answer is, should you? And if they have any reason at all not to, I say, you're right, don't do it.
You know, that point about the illegality is, I think, a really important point. It can be pretty hard to not have somewhere in the back of your mind that, wow, this is illegal. The stormtroopers could come breaking through the doors at any moment.
Well, it's true it's illegal, but the government, in spite of it being unbelievably obtuse in many areas, doesn't seem to care much about any individual user. The government really does worry about people who are manufacturing and selling, because that's really, you know, kind of where the leverage is. So, yes, it is illegal, but that's more in terms of kind of adding a shadow over it. So if you take another situation like Burning Man,
I was just going to ask you about Burning Man. Very synchronistic.
Well, Burning Man seems to be a place where the purpose of the Black Rock Rangers, who are the people who kind of are the government for the week, is they're there to keep you out of trouble, and they're also there to keep the regular law officials off your back. And so, again, they're... there's lots of use of all kinds of substances, many of which I can neither pronounce or spell, that are taken at Burning Man. And there are casualties, there are problems. They have a wonderful psychological support system called Sanctuary, and they have a medical team and so forth. And people get, usually very naive people make very naive mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a place in which a lot of creativity certainly has appeared, and a lot of that probably is fueled in some part by serious and probably fairly safe psychedelic use.
Yeah, just before you started talking about Burning Man, I was on the cusp of asking you if you've attended Burning Man. I haven't, but I've listened to a podcast called The Psychedelic Salon. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yes, I am. I was actually planning to go this year. I had a couple of speeches lined up with various groups, and I had a heart virus, which said, I think you're going to rest for a few months, more than you ever intended.
Yeah.
So I missed my Burning Man this year, and I hope to go next year.
Okay. Well, as we wind down, is there anything that you'd like to add, anything you hope to talk about that maybe I didn't evoke?
Yeah, there's two other uses that we didn't talk about much. One is creative problem solving, and we did a study using senior scientists and giving them a lower dose of LSD or mescaline, depending on what we had most available, and they were basically there to solve very hard, totally rational scientific problems, such as in physics, in chip design, in architecture. And it was generally felt at the time that this was, this couldn't happen. Then the results were stunning, with products being accepted by companies, patents, publications, and that whole area of lower dose, again, set and setting being very, very, very critical, is something we're only beginning to re-explore. Again, if you go around Silicon Valley, there's an awful lot of people who would say, well, I did have my best ideas when using a lower dose of psychedelics, but I certainly never did it formally. That's one area. The other area that we didn't talk about is something I'm currently researching called microdosing, which is using a tiny amount, much, much less than you would even notice, which is what's called sub-perceptual, which is psychedelics in past a certain dose, the world gets brighter, your pupils open, all kinds of interesting things happen. But below that dose, none of that occurs. And what people are reporting when they use what's called a microdose, and the person who invented LSD, Albert Hoffman, said this was a very under-researched area, they're reporting that their day simply goes better, that they're a little more able to focus, a little more creative, a little kinder, a little more patient, that they may do one more set of reps at the gym. It's not a big deal. But what they're finding that it is doing what Adderall or the Ritalin used to do, in a sense of giving them a clearer energy, but without any of the physiological side effects that these other stronger drugs have. And so that's an area I'm researching. I'm getting protocols from around the country of people who are doing it and just know that I'm interested, because obviously I can't do that research, both because I'm not an MD and the government is not interested at the moment in that particular subject. But those are two areas in the book that are really not available elsewhere, and I think are where some of the cutting edge is.
Oh, I'm really glad that you were able to get that in here. That's great. Well, this has been delightful, Jim. So, Dr. James Fadiman, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, I love being on this show, and thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. James Fadiman as much as I did. Some of you might be wondering if I experimented with psychedelics back in the 60s. I don't think I've ever spoken to that directly in past episodes, even though a number of the interviews might have stimulated speculation. I won't be coy about this. I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, probably more or less around the same time that Jim Fadiman was at Stanford. Maybe a little later. I think he's a bit older than I am. I was one of a fairly small band of psychology graduate students at Michigan who did experiment with LSD and other psychedelics during the late 60s. LSD was already declared illegal by this time, but I had heard things that made me think it was an important experience for someone who planned to be a therapist to have. At least that was my rationale, or rationalization, whichever. I was not blessed with experienced guides. All of my experiences were with others who were also, quote, tripping. I would have to say that our orientation was a mix of recreational and spiritual. Many of these adventures were under conditions that would be ill-advised, given what we know today along the lines that Jim was speaking about in the interview. We knew set and setting were important, but didn't always heed that advice. As a consequence, I would have to say I had both good and bad experiences. I have many times reflected that I probably should have only taken the first LSD experience and stopped there. You can only be a virgin once. It was a positively mind-blowing experience that first time, and I think subsequent trips were in part an attempt to recreate that initial experience. But we can never have the same experience twice, and it took me a long time to learn that. As Thomas Wolfe's novel title declares, you can't go home again. And that's been one of the deepest truths for me in my life. The first and maybe most dramatic thing for me when that first LSD dose came on was a sense of familiarity. It was like, oh yeah, I remember this. How could I forget? I think what happened is that it took me back to the sort of wide-open awareness of early childhood, or maybe even infancy, in which everything was new, sparkling, and vibrant. It felt very familiar and like returning home. I won't go into all the details of that first or subsequent experiences, but I would say that subsequent experiences were an attempt to get back to that same place, but there was no getting back. My theory is that the ego, if you will, is that part of us that seeks to master the world, whether we consciously will it or not. So while the first experience completely overwhelmed my ego for quite a few hours, on subsequent ones, ego mastery kicked in more and more, so that it was less mind-blowing. And I think ego loss is what it's really all about. It's not easy to evaluate what the impact of these experiences were on my life. We can't really know about the road not taken. I would say that those experiences definitely expanded my view of consciousness and of reality. I think they definitely set up an interest in Eastern spirituality, humanistic, and transpersonal psychology. I'm not sure if there ever would have been a shrink wrap radio, or at least not such a wide-ranging one as you have here. I want to emphasize Jim's caveat that there are risks involved. It's not for everyone. One of my fellow graduate students who was on that first LSD experience with me later had a profound psychotic break. He continued to take LSD until his behavior in the graduate program became so inappropriate that it got him kicked out. Later, we learned that his mother was institutionalized for schizophrenia, and he had a fantasy of reuniting with her in a mental hospital. As far as I know, he never recovered. I don't know if LSD caused his psychosis. Clearly, he had a genetic predisposition. Maybe he would have gone crazy anyway, or maybe not. I don't think we can know. I know there were times when I felt very crazy and others when I felt very frightened, but I retained enough ego and had support from my friends to know that it would pass. So I would say I experienced both the ecstasy and the agony. I definitely agree with Jim that psychedelics have powerful therapeutic and creative potential if administered with caring and care. I think it's absolutely essential that we continue with legal, officially sanctioned research on these potentially powerful, life-changing, transformative allies. You know, it's now a day later, and as a kind of afterthought, let me add that the various psychedelics I experimented with back so long ago were essentially street drugs. Consequently, I have no way of knowing for certain their provenance, their dosage, or their purity. It certainly is possible that any bad experiences I had were the result of wrong dosage or lack of purity. So, despite what I said earlier about you can't go home again, if I had the opportunity to take LSD under the sorts of conditions Jim Fadiman talks about in his Guide to Voyagers, and if I knew for certain the purity and dosage, I would have to consider yet one more journey, just to remind myself of that transcendent reality one more time.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Together, all part of this humankind. Mystery Crab Radio, you will find you. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
Hello again, everyone. I'm happy to announce that there is a new transcript available on the site. Thanks to Trina Fink, who transcribed number 256, Mindful Sleep, Mindful Dreams, with Ruben Nyman, PhD. That was really a key conversation, I think, that helped to transform some of my own sleeping habits. So I'm especially grateful to Trina for doing this one. Thanks, Trina. We have some other transcripts that have been in process for some time. So if you're one of the folks who volunteered to do a transcription and it's been some time, please check in with me and let me know how it's going. Or if you're completely bogged down or overwhelmed, send me as much as you were able to complete and I may be able to find another volunteer to finish up the job. As I've said in the past, I think these transcripts add a lot of value. I know they are very helpful to me, for example, if I'm putting together a post for my Psychology Today blog, and I want to reference something one of my guests said. Also, I know that some people actually prefer to whip through reading something rather than the slower process of listening. I recently had breakfast with an old friend who was feeling guilty that she hasn't been following Shrink Wrap Radio in a while. She got all excited, though, when I mentioned that many of the episodes have transcripts, because she admitted she doesn't like to have things in her ears, which is to say earphones or earbuds. So let's keep those transcripts coming. I'm wishing I had one for my interview with Lindsay Doran, because I'm thinking I'd like to build a Psychology Today blog post around her observations about Sylvester Stallone's movie Rocky. Speaking of transcribers, I heard from Joe Kelly in Australia, who was one of my first volunteer transcribers and who transcribed quite a few episodes, and she wrote to let me know she had used our new Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar to order the film Into Great Silence for her meditation group. I was so pleased that she was able to get that film in that way. So I hope all of you will remember to use our new Amazon widget for anything and everything that you get from Amazon. It certainly does not need to be limited to books. If you'll just use the Amazon widget on our page, then our tracking code will be appended to whatever you buy, and you'll be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio. And, by the way, I'm putting a direct link in the show notes to Dr. James Fadiman's book, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And while you're looking at the right-hand sidebar, notice the new widget for our CE unit courses at the Zur Institute. Right now, there are 4 courses you can take just for listening to Shrink Wrap Radio episodes. And the 3rd Jung course will be going up quite soon. And they are quite reasonably priced at about $10 per CE unit. Thanks to those of you who have clicked on that big green donate button in the right-hand sidebar on the shrinkwrapradio.com site. I know there are others of you out there who are filled with good intentions, but you're not listening in front of your computer. You keep meaning to do it and forgetting. Today is the day to act on those good intentions and get a healthy shot of endorphins in your brain for the effort.
Hi, this is Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, Jungian analyst, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolin, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Let's turn to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Deb, who responded to my thanks for her donation with the following. Dear Dr. Dave, thanks so much for your personal acknowledgement of my donation, which was long overdue since I stumbled onto your podcast some time ago and have been benefiting from them ever since. It's been my good fortune to find you at a time in my life when I seem thirsty for this kind of teaching. You have made it possible for me to sit at the feet of so many inspiring people and listen to them share their knowledge and passion for their work. Interviews with James Hollis and Richard Shashry, to name a few, have led me to further reading, which has offered much-needed meaning, excitement, and hope to my life. How great. I also have such an appreciation for you in sticking to your guns in your interviewing style and format of your show, and not caving in to potential revenue sources which, in my thinking, could compromise the quality and integrity of your show. You really are a breath of fresh air in a world which seems much of the time to be negatively impacted by big pockets. Go, Dave. Well, thank you so much, Deb, for that. I really appreciate that vote of confidence. I also want to say thanks to Lisa, who wrote in offering to transcribe number 132, The Psychology of Doll Work, with my longtime friend and colleague, Jerry Ann Olson. And another Debbie wrote in response to my thanks for her donation. She wrote, "You're more than welcome. It gives me pleasure to be able to give something back to you in return for all that you have given us." And it's signed Debbie. And Morgan posted the following on as a comment to show number 276 on the Positive Psychology Conference. "Dr. Dave, thank you for the Seligman keynote. I have no idea why it wasn't podcast by the event producers, but as usual, you stepped up and made this amazing material available to us. Thank you so much. I've listened to nearly everything you've posted on both Shrink Wrap and Wise Counsel. It's literally the only source for these types of interviews. You and your work are priceless. I'm currently a psych graduate student and am, needless to say, broke. But someday I will donate something to your show. Please keep her going while listening." And so thanks very much for that note, Morgan. And I'm glad to hear that you're a grad student in psychology. Keep plugging away. And it really pleases me to know that students such as yourself are finding this show and making good use of the material. Finally, we hear from Quinn, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been a big fan of your podcast for the last couple of years. I've fallen a bit behind these last few months, but now I'm catching up again. I was just listening to your podcast with Jerry Trumbull, number 262, and you noted that you should interview someone from the HeartMath group. Since this interview was a little ways back, I wasn't sure if you had already found someone in this field to interview. I was recently introduced to the theories and philosophies that constitute HeartMath. I must say I'm very intrigued with the research being done in this field. Having said that, I know someone I believe would be a marvelous person for you to interview. His name is Dr. Robert Whitehouse. And below I have a link to his biography located on his website and his email address. After reading through his bio, I think you'll be very interested in interviewing him, as his breadth of knowledge on the subject is just short of amazing. I have personally done some biofeedback work with Dr. Whitehouse, and in addition to his expertise regarding HeartMath, he's a very compassionate person and wonderful to talk with. I hope you will agree. I just asked him if I could suggest him as a potential interviewee, and he said he would be happy to do an interview with you." And that's signed, thanks, and that's from Quinn. Quinn, thank you so much for that reminder. It kind of had slipped from the top of my mind, and it is something I want to follow up with. And I did check out those references to Dr. Whitehouse, and I agree he would make a great guest. So hopefully I will remember to follow up on that. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. James Fadiman, for his update on the positive potential of psychedelics. My next episode will feature an interview with the well-known Jungian analyst and author Jean Shinoda Bolen, MD. You might know her from her book on goddesses in every woman, among others. We'll be discussing her latest book titled Like a Tree. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, It's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.